From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida moves towards suspending any and all vaccine mandates for anyone.
We're going to be creating situations in which they are more likely to get sick and more likely to die.
Also this week, a months-long water emergency prompts some Florida lawmakers to urge state government to take over the town's water system.
I'm not putting the blame on the current administration, the current folks that are serving now. I think it's just been a mismanagement of funds over the years.
We'll also have a sit-down with the state's attorney general, discover how many undocumented immigrants are contributing to the state economy, and give you a sea turtle update. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Doctors, medical experts, and politicians on both sides of the aisle are pushing back on a plan from Governor Ron DeSantis and State Surgeon General Joseph Latipo to end all vaccine requirements in the state. Tristan Wood reports the effort has raised questions about who has the power to make that change.
State law mandates vaccines for kids attending public school, including shots that protect against measles, mumps, rubella, polio, and chickenpox. But Florida's Surgeon General says he's against rules that require anyone to put anything in their body.
Every last one of them is wrong and drips with disdain and slavery.
Latipo, who previously worked to keep Florida from having COVID-19 vaccine requirements, says he's working to abolish the state's other vaccination rules.
Who am I to tell you what your child should put in your body? I don't have that right. Your body is a gift from God. What you put into your body is because of your relationship with your body and your God.
Some Republicans, like U.S. Senator Rick Scott, have come out in opposition to the change. Scott points out the state already allows exemptions for religious reasons, health, or personal beliefs. And many medical groups, including the American Medical Association and Florida Medical Association, have responded to the announcement by reaffirming their support for vaccinations. Eric Feldman is a professor of medical ethics and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He says he's not surprised by the news.
If one didn't see this coming in Florida, then we probably haven't been paying much attention to what the Surgeon General has been saying and doing for a good number of years.
Feldman says Latipo's framing of vaccinations as an individual choice ignores how vaccinations limit the spread of disease and protect everyone in society.
It's like I tell my students at Penn, if you're feeling sick, don't come to class. It's your obligation to the community to stay home and not get us sick. And staying home isn't just for you, it's for us. Getting vaccinated. Your Surgeon General says getting vaccinated should just be an individual family choice. But it's not just an individual family choice, because your choice impinges on the opportunities and health and well-being of other people.
Feldman thinks Latipo's efforts will hurt children in Florida. He pointed to a report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that estimates from 1994 to 2023, routine childhood vaccinations have prevented approximately 508 million cases of illness, 32 million hospitalizations, and over a million deaths nationwide.
If we're going to stop vaccinating our kids, we're going to be creating situations in which they are more likely to get sick and more likely to die from things they could have prevented.
Democratic politicians point out the move from Latipo is counter to promises he previously made. Here he is speaking about the issue back in 2023 when he said he supported current laws about vaccine requirements.
I think that the Florida statutes are appropriate, and the Florida statutes provide mandated vaccines along with an opportunity for families, parents who believe otherwise to opt out, and I think that's appropriate.
DeSantis and Latipo do not have the power to roll back the current requirements alone. Florida law mandates that kids get vaccinated for several illnesses, like polio, measles, mumps, and tetanus, before attending public school. The legislature would need to pass a law to change that requirement. But Democratic State Senator Tina Pawlowski thinks the writing is on the wall.
I almost feel like he's in prepping us for this, you know, slowly but surely sowing doubt in everyone's mind.
She thinks anti-vaccine messaging from DeSantis and Latipo is responsible for the drop in child vaccination rates in Florida.
So we're almost not at herd immunity for our immunizations like we were before, simply because those in charge are feeding into the controversy and the conspiracy that really should not exist. There's no scientific basis for it.
Feldman agrees. He says he thinks the messaging campaign from Latipo will continue to erode public trust in healthcare.
That's about as destructive of the public health system and as misleading and dishonest as I think one could find.
Florida's move comes as U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. continues national attacks against vaccines, including firing the entire 17-member advisory panel on immunization practices at the CDC earlier this year. I'm Tristan Wood.
A pair of Florida lawmakers is pushing to give the state control of two rural water and sewer systems following a months-long emergency that left Apalachicola residents with stinking, unusable water. Margie Menzel reports.
City officials say the foul water was partly due to the hot weather coming on. Another factor was the impact of Hurricane Helene's 65-mile-per-hour winds last year on the ancient water system. In any case, the city's representatives in Tallahassee were not pleased. When Senator Corey Simon and Representative Jason Schoaf led a recent delegation meeting in Apalachicola, they proposed expanding the boundaries of the East Point Water and Sewer District to include the utilities on both St. George Island and the city of Apalachicola. Simon says the state's taxpayers have been footing part of the bill for the city's water crisis.
Over the last several years, the state has given the city of Appalach millions of dollars to provide for infrastructure, to make sure the folks that live in Appalach have reliable drinking water, cooking water, and they never paid the money back, or they haven't paid all of that money back. It was a loan from the state. But the state has continued to invest.
Simon says he thinks the city officials haven't been using those funds correctly.
They've been using those utility dollars and transferring those dollars that should have been going to the infrastructure of their water to transfer into their general revenue. And they've been using it as a tax base. Instead of being truthful with the taxpayer on what their taxes should actually be, they are hiding it by transferring dollars from their utility to their general revenue.
He says the problems stretch back well beyond the current city officials.
I'm not putting the blame on the current administration, the current folks that are serving now. I think it's just been a mismanagement of funds over the years and not doing what's right for the people of Appalach.
However, Apalachicola City Commissioner Adrian Elliott isn't sure the city's residents would want to give up their utility system.
There's a lot of questions from my constituents already. People are concerned about the concept of a utility being taken away and losing their voice on how their utilities are run, even if we have had problems.
Elliott is also worried about the city's tax base.
I am cautious about having the utilities completely taken over because the crux of the issue here is that we don't have the tax base to sustain our utilities. So if it becomes state-owned, then who's to say down the road the state decides that it's not worth taxpayer money to fund that system anymore and sells it off? It could drastically change people's lives around here.
Meanwhile, Simon and Schoaf say they're also looking to install sewers on St. George Island to reduce the risk of sewage polluting the Apalachicola Bay. Schoaf says he has confidence in the East Point Water and Sewer District to manage utilities on the island and in Appalach.
And we believe overwhelmingly that the people are wanting this type of steady, proven entity to come in and take over and provide these services.
Simon and Schoaf emphasize that nothing is a done deal at this point. But when they asked for a vote on their proposal at the delegation meeting, no one objected. I'm Margie Menzel.
Several state and national voting rights organizations want Governor Ron DeSantis to reconsider his call for a mid-decade round of congressional redistricting to help Republicans keep control of the U.S. House in 2026. The groups, including Equal Ground, the Southern Poverty Law Center, Florida Rising Together, Common Cause Florida, and the Palm Beach County Voting Rights Coalition, feel redrawing districts would cause unprecedented disruption and lead to voter disenfranchisement. President Donald Trump has pushed for mid-decade redistricting in Republican-led states. Republicans hold 20 of Florida's 28 U.S. House seats. Equal Ground Executive Director Genesis Robinson says the GOP is already overrepresented in Congress.
Why should there be such an imbalance? And to think that we would go even further and further insulate power in the hands of Republican leadership is astonishing. You know, we want fairness, we want parity.
Besides the possibility of the legislature redrawing congressional lines before the 2026 elections, DeSantis and other Florida leaders have asked the Trump administration for additional U.S. House seats, contending Florida's population was undercounted in the 2020 census. Redistricting typically happens once a decade after the U.S. Census. The last round of redistricting happened in 2022. Coming up on Capitol Report, we'll hear from Florida's Attorney General and his rationale for keeping Alligator Alcatraz open as an immigrant holding center.
We are detaining a lot of individuals. Florida's leading the way in supporting the Trump administration.
And if you've ever wondered if all those extra cost Florida vanity license plates are worth it, we'll tell you about one that truly is a solid investment.
It is directly helping endangered animals. It is funding organizations and nonprofits to do work that protects these animals.
Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer hasn't slowed down since being appointed in February. In the latest Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, Uthmeyer delves into many topics, including immigration. He talks about the creation of Alligator Alcatraz and says the detention center is needed for public safety. Here's an excerpt.
Right now, we're in the middle of another giant controversy, a lot of litigation being defended by your office and lawyers that are working for your office. And that's the immigration, the enforcement of the immigration. I mentioned to you as we were setting up that Archbishop Lenski was our guest. You're just butting up against him, not literally, not figuratively, but yes, he was our last guest. And he had a lot of thoughts about Alligator Alcatraz. A lot of people have a lot of thoughts about Alligator Alcatraz. I do editing. I write stories. I've read a lot of the litigation, you know, a lot of the filings by the state, the feds, the plaintiffs. So I'm pretty rehearsed in that. I also, we subscribe to Getty Pictures. And when I'm looking for pictures to go, I see that people standing out in front of the sign, taking pictures of themselves with doing the thumbs up and stuff. So I know it's controversial. And I just, first things first, as we talk about this, the president, President Trump, came down here and he credited you with this great idea and coming up with this idea and this location. So tell us, tell the divas, was this your idea and how long have you been working on it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've been looking at this piece of land for a long period of time. It crosses over both Collier and Miami-Dade County lines. The county has owned it, I think, basically forever. There was an airport that was constructed back in the 60s and 70s. They were going to have the Concorde flights flying out of there. Ultimately, they decided...
Oh my gosh, the Concorde flights.
Ultimately, they scrapped the program. The facility was never made operational. But you have an 11,000-foot runway. You've got a lot of tarmac space. It's over 30 square miles of development that's all already been developed. The governor's office, our state, you know, did not do that for the detention site. And Miami-Dade's been upkeeping it. But we've been talking about the state acquiring it. you know, for either the state guard or emergency management purposes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I've been traveling the state working with the sheriffs on the immigration enforcement, we are detaining a lot of individuals. Florida's leading the way in supporting the Trump administration. And we kept hearing from sheriffs, you know, we're gonna have, you know, a detention issue. We need more help. Homeland Security was saying the same thing.
They need more beds.
And, you know, I saw President Trump proposing, you know, to open the original Alcatraz. And I don't know if that can happen or not. And obviously, this is somewhat of a different context, but it kind of gave me the idea. I said, well, you know what? We need more detention space here in Florida. We've got this facility. It's over 30 square miles. I know the environmentalists are you know, alleging that we're impacting the environment. But as we've argued in court, you know, there's no permanent infrastructure, no brick and mortar, no plumbing. I mean, everything is brought in and out. It's light infrastructure, tents, and, you know,
soft-sided.
Yeah.
I think they call it the soft-sided facility south or something, the feds. I've seen that, right?
Yeah, I would actually say this is a great example of sustainability. If we need to house a population that's been relocated due to a hurricane or a disaster, I mean, we're doing some novel things here, bringing in water, bringing in bathrooms, bringing in temporary kitchens. We in less than a week were able to stand up a facility that could house thousands of people very safely, getting them the resources they need, and we'd have the ability to move it, you know, on a dime. So it's worked out well. We do have many immigrants there. Most of them, I would tell the Archbishop, have committed some very heinous crimes. I mean, you have murders, you have people that have committed rape, sexual assault, assault of children, human trafficking. I'll get you the list of a lot of the people there if you want it. I mean, this is real. You have people that have committed heinous crimes in this facility, and I do not see the Archbishop, you know, going out and calling out these crimes, talking about praying for the victims, giving out the example of the victims. And I know that the Archbishop has had a strong opinion on immigration, but at the end of the day, you have to have security and sovereignty. And I've been to the Vatican many times, one of my favorite places in the world. There's a giant wall surrounding it. It's secured. You can't just roll in. You got to go through the right way. You know, they've got the Swiss guard that's there conducting security. You go through metal detectors. You got to have an appointment in many cases. So, I mean, security is central to safety, public safety for American families. And that's why I think enforcing the law is so critical. And I'm appreciative that the Trump administration has done so.
That was Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. Florida is home to about 1.6 million undocumented immigrants, the third largest share in the country. While the Trump administration often portrays them as criminals, Jeannie Economos of the Farm Workers Association of Florida says most are hardworking, tax-paying members of their communities. She spoke with WLRN's Tim Padgett about the challenges migrant workers face, especially those without legal status.
People are afraid to speak out. People are afraid to go to work, period. Mm-hmm. But when they do go to work, they're so desperate for, you know, having a job, being able to support their families. So they're not going to complain if some of the regulations are violated. I've spent 30 years working with farm workers, and we have in the past made complaints on behalf of farm workers when there's violations of pesticide regulations. Mm-hmm. And I will say that during the first Trump administration, people were so afraid. We got almost no complaints from farm workers because they were more concerned about being able to come home to their children in the evenings, making sure that their family members were safe, that their kids were safe in school, that they weren't going to get deported. And we're seeing the same thing now.
Aside from the rather backbreaking nature of field work, do you think concerns like exposure to pesticides and extreme heat are other important reasons why so few U.S. citizens and other legally documented workers enter into this kind of labor?
Well, absolutely. And I will say also, maybe about 10 or 15 years ago, the United Farm Workers in California, when there was, again, a big anti-immigrant sentiment, United Farm Workers had a campaign called Take My Job.
Right.
And they put the call out for citizen workers to come out and do the farm work. And I think one worker lasted a whole week and everybody else couldn't even last the whole day.
Yeah.
So it's brutal work and there are exposures to heat and pesticides and the conditions are just really grueling.
Yeah.
And so you're not going to get U.S. citizens to come and do that work.
Jeannie, you've worked with migrant farm workers, as you said, in Florida for three decades now. Most are from Latin America, especially Mexico and Central America. What's the most important thing you've learned in that time about the people who come here? What stands out most to you about their human profile, as it were?
It's personal to me. It's not, they're not just a category of worker. When you say farm workers, a lot of people just, you know, see people's backs and leaning over and harvesting food, but they're three-dimensional people. I've been to their quinceañeras. I've been to church and to funerals.
I should point out to our listeners, the quinceañera is a Latina girl's 15th birthday.
Yes. And it's too easy to put people into a category and then dismiss them or stereotype them just because they're doing some of the hardest work in our country and because they tend to be quote-unquote invisible doesn't mean that they're any less family-oriented and caring, loving people. And I will say there's also a lot of Haitian farm workers in Florida, too, more than in other states.
Right. How then is President Trump's and Governor DeSantis's sweeping deportation campaign affecting those communities from your standpoint, and how does that stand to eventually affect the rest of us?
It's incomprehensible, actually, because it's demonizing people without even knowing who they are. You know, what's really tragic is we talk about wanting to make our country better and our communities better, but if we are tearing families apart, that creates trauma. And that trauma lasts for a long time. So we are not creating stronger communities if we're tearing people and families apart. We need to build our communities up. And honestly, I'm really concerned about the future of agriculture in Florida because agriculture is already at risk because of climate change, hurricanes, droughts, floods in agriculture. It's at risk because of overdevelopment. Farmers are selling their land to development because they can make more money selling their land than continuing to grow crops. And because of the fact that we are targeting farm workers like this. And if we keep doing that, then we're not going to have people here in agriculture anymore.
That was Jeannie Economos of the Farm Workers Association of Florida speaking with WLRN's Tim Padgett. A Florida lawmaker wants to explore the possibility of creating a Florida Springs National Park, but some environmental stakeholders in the Sunshine State have concerns. Central Florida Public Media's Molly Durig has more.
Republican Congressman Randy Fine represents Florida's District 6. He recently proposed a federal bill directing a study of how suitable and feasible it would be to create a Florida Springs National Park north of Orlando. Fine says he's enjoyed touring all 63 of the country's national parks with his children, and he thinks Florida's freshwater springs are just as deserving of a national designation. Fine says a national park would enhance protections for impaired Florida springs while also boosting tourism.
But what I'm not is an expert in the creation of a national park. I want the experts to figure out how to turn that into a national park by consulting with all of the groups that would be affected.
That's why Fine says he proposed the Path to Florida Springs National Park Act. But not everyone is excited about the idea. A Change.org petition against the bill has nearly 5,000 signatures. Ryan Smart is executive director of Florida Springs Council, a nonprofit advocating for policy to protect the state's freshwater springs. Smart says while he appreciates the intention behind Fine's proposed legislation, the reality is a national park wouldn't help Florida Springs.
You know, if the federal government wants to come in and give us land trusts and purchase lands around springs to be managed, that would be wonderfully helpful. But changing the name on the sign or the level that they're managed on, it can't do any good.
Smart says what would help Florida Springs is cutting back on pollution from fertilizer and septic tanks and requiring water conservation. In Orlando, I'm Molly Durig.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, remember last week's story about a rescued sea turtle? Well, we have a related tale this week. Florida offers more than 100 specialty license plates Residents pay extra for them, and the money goes to a particular cause. The second most popular plate in the state is titled Helping Sea Turtles Survive. The artwork is blue and sand-colored with a loggerhead hatchling crawling toward the surf. The state has issued more than 100,000 of these plates supporting sea turtle conservation and research. WUSF's Douglas Soule tells us how one organization uses the money.
Kathy and Joey Satterfield bought two sea turtle license plates. They pay an extra $23 for each of them every year.
For us, it's worth it. And it brings awareness. We're one of the largest nesting areas for loggerheads, and that's a big thing. So let's support them.
But the retired couple takes their support a step further. They volunteer with a group that rescues hatchlings in North Florida's St. George Island. Last week, they pulled a tiny loggerhead from a pool filter. It crawled away from the Gulf, disoriented by artificial light. The Satterfields named it Marco. They took Marco to the small town of Panacea, home of the Gulf Specimen Marine Laboratory and Aquarium. Staff there give Marco and other rescued hatchlings a swim test.
Good breath, good breath. You're good.
They pour water in their containers to see if they have the strength to lift their heads and breathe. Marco passes.
So we did get one breath. Do you want to see him get two?
Hunter Eichler oversees the aquarium. She's grateful for the Satterfields, not just for the rescue, but for the license plates. A state conservation program gets around 70% of the plate proceeds. The rest goes to grants for places like her lab.
It is directly helping endangered animals. It is funding organizations and nonprofits to do work that protects these animals.
The aquarium is filled with educational displays paid for by the plates. There's signage, life-size turtle replicas, and even a sea turtle wheel of survival.
We landed on boat strike. Looks like this turtle's gonna have to come in for rehabilitation.
This year's grant paid for a brand new portable x-ray machine. Eichler is thrilled to unpack it.
I am very excited. It's really hard for us to get a turtle to x-ray once because we're transporting them off site right now, but to get them x-rayed again is even harder.
Last year's grant paid for a new turtle transport van.
Nice, fancy new van. Our old one, the door fell off, totally rusted through because we're in saltwater environments rescuing these animals. But we were really lucky to receive this grant from the Sea Turtle License Plate Program because we're the only sea turtle rescue from Panama City down to Clearwater. So it's a big area to cover, but this tool helps us a lot.
Eichler's team uses the van to keep turtles safe and comfortable.
We can transport them without having to worry about the stress of transport leading to a negative outcome.
I guess the same goes for the interns in the back.
Yep, same thing.
Interns and a heap of supplies are in the back. They drive to a nearby beach to prepare to release a young endangered turtle named Aggie. Hi, Aggie. Eichler took care of Aggie and four other green sea turtles following Hurricane Helene. She washed ashore, injured and sick, and is the last turtle being released back into the wild. Eichler sets her down by the water.
Where is she?
She's gone? She's going back to the wild?
Back at the lab, Eichler stands beside Aggie's empty tank, tears in her eyes. Is it going to be weird not having her here?
It's definitely going to be, but one thing I've learned after all this time, it doesn't stay calm for long. Another one always shows up.
She plans to apply for more grants. Next on her list is an anesthesia machine so the lab can do more in-depth surgeries. I'm Douglas Soule in Panacea.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Derek Hamm, Tim Patchett, Molly Durig, and Douglas Soule. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.